Mr. Man, Reel 15. We'll come back to Germano later on in the story in its proper place. But can we stay with Anzio just a little longer?
Yeah.
We've talked about the fatigue and the situation that you found yourself in. In a dangerous situation like that, where death can be at any moment or an injury can be at any moment, in your particular case personally, was religion any strength to you? Were you a religious person?
Oh, yeah, before I went abroad, I was confirmed by a major Spoolie, they called him. That was in the village, Major Spoolie. And he gave us the New Testament, a little booklet, just to have somewhere, and I carried that all with me. Another point in regard to religion, we once went through a town, as it were, and the Italians lined up on the side, and one of them passed me a crucifix, a small crucifix, and this crucifix, it had a drop of holy water in it. It was like a little spirit level, you could say, was in there. And she again, I don't know if she wanted, we're actually moving through this town. Gave me that, and then I put that eventually onto with my identity disc, which grew on my neck, and I kept that through the floor. The sister had that there. At Anzio as well, when we got out, they did have a church service. I can remember going to that. We were just in the open field, and the padre was there having the service, and it was disturbed by a German fighter plane coming over, did a bit of strafing. But religious, I suppose anybody who isn't really religious, that comes if you're in a danger with being like shelled or fired that way, you get yourself down, you would say, oh God help me. Whether you're religious or not, I'm sure that happens to them. But yes, I was a religious fanatic or anything like that, but I was a believer, and I still am. Even though I still go to church every Sunday. Yeah.
And did you feel God's protection in these dangerous situations?
I think more so since looking back, there were many, many times I looked back and I thought, well, it must have helped me. And I remember a point once where we were in an area, and this little tent was torn, actually, this little tent that we were in, it was near a tree. And we moved from this position, I don't know what it felt anyway, we moved it. And then came the time we actually went back into this identical area, and where my tent had been, or my pal's, there was a shell hole. And I thought, well, dear me, you know, if I'd been there and that had come over, might have been a few days after we'd gone away, but at some time a shell had come over, and the identical spot, there was a shell hole. Well, that was somebody must have been watching over.
What was the morale of the unit like by the end of this first week of action?
Well, I suppose you've got a varied one. You could get them where, if they got out, and they were depressed in that, obviously, but they could get out with the sound and they've got a few vino or something like that down them, it seems to relieve them, and they talk about things. Even Italians used to say, like, how long is the war going to last? Well, that was a question that was on everybody's lip. How long was it going to last? And of course, none of us knew. But you could get together, and I suppose after the initial pull out, and you know, you had a good washing, something to eat, and got changed around in a couple of days, things seemed to pass. You know, you still get your memory, of course, cropping up, but you would start talking about all sorts of things. You would get mail from home, and that. That was a subject to talk about. You knew that you weren't actually going away from it. You'd probably have to go in again. But getting back to the Anzio touch, of course, when we come out, we didn't know what was happening. But we were actually sent away for a while.
How important is it to feel or to have your comrades around you in a frontline situation?
Oh, I think it's very, very important. You were one family and all. I don't recall arguments between anybody if you were there. And it was a case of stick with one another. It ought to give you a bit of morale as well. There's nothing worse than if you were on your own. A place like that, with nobody to accompany you. Even just if there was just one of somebody beside you. That gave you some morale.
Was there a conscious effort during or preceding the action situation to remind you of unit morale, of the unit's history, to keep you going in effect, unit pride?
I suppose, yes. I mean, the main thing, I think, was self-preservation. Naturally, you couldn't get anybody around to give you a boost of talk or anything like that in the position that you were in. No, I think the self-survival kept you going. The luxury was being when a bottle of rum would come up for a platoon of men, which was for 30 men, and get a sip of that. Because next thing, you were just wondering, when are we going to get relieved? We could just drift on. Might have been the next day, might have been a few days there. No, I don't know. So you didn't have letters with you to read. You weren't supposed to carry the letters of sent previously or identification, so you couldn't reminisce through letters from home. It was a bit of a bleak existence when there was nothing, no activity or anything. We often say, like, I said to people, you know, could you imagine going, say, out on the moors, for instance, and digging a hole roughly the size of a grave and standing in that for a few days and open to the elements and not a night's sleep or that. If it was cold, it's cold. You can't really get warm. It's something I think you really got to experience to realize just what it was.
Was the slit trench relatively effective cover against shell and mortar fire?
Well, if you could get down below the level of the earth, it would have failed. Let's say you could press yourself to the earth and you could imagine that you were pressing yourself into the ground, that you were making your body flatter. That's my experience. And if you're ever in a position like that, that's the time when you used to say, oh God, get me out of this one.
It must be a somewhat impotent situation. You can't do anything. The shells are raining down on you.
With a ditch or an old tree to drop behind. I mean, you could drop behind a tree, the shell can come from that side of it, but at least you had the feeling that it was cover. And another thing was, at times you would cover your head. I mean, it was only your arm. You had a tin hat on, of course. But your arm would, you know, that was covering your head at the same time. When you think back on this, the rest of your body was sort of exposed, that was it. You always used to say, if your number's on it, you'll get it. And then after, say, a shelling or small arms fire coming at you, if that the end of that episode, you say, well, none of them had my number on it. I just hope that the next occurrence would be safe.
What effect on your nerves did a heavy bombardment create?
Well, I think more or less, whilst you were there in that coward position, will you say, you're just wishing to get out of it. And when it did cease, it was only a matter of seconds, I suppose, like when you were thinking, is that the last one? And eventually you would move yourself. And I suppose one way to be thankful that you've just got through it. And it was just another episode. You think, didn't forward to the next one, but you knew there would be one at some time. But it could shake up. But I mean, I was no brave man or anything like that. I felt the effects of it. But I think afterwards, you often say, I can't bother but doing that one. And you've got the stage after a few times, you'd more or less accept it, but you've got to know. That was a feeling.
What was the most frightening German weapon that you had to experience, in your opinion?
I think for me it was the German Spandau machine gun, because it was such a rate of fire. But if you were caught with one, you'd get more than one bullet into your office. That and mimes, any type of mime, which was all sort of, I wouldn't say exactly terrified, but you know, I got out with no mimes here. Shouldn't have liked to be being disabled by a mime or the German Spandau machine. And I suppose after that you would say it would be a sniper's rifle. But I got some of them were good shots, isn't it? Fortunately not with me. I've had them near me, and I've even had one bullet in the back of me, little past. Really all of the weapons, I suppose. I mean, nobody would like bombing a shell in a mortar and that. But a Spandau, that I think that was the infantryman's first terror weapon. Really fire.
Was there any way in which you were trained or taught how to deal with these variety of weapons when they were opening up on you?
It was just a case of trying to pick the position. If you pick the position, you fire at it. And you have to take cover, and of course at the same time it was up to you to defeat the enemy. I must admit, you didn't used to pop your head up and keep looking around, because if you did that, you'd never get your head down again. You'd pop up another glance. Or at times, usually in the platoon, you would have a periscope. And of course, you could put a periscope up and go around with that. Usually, it was an NCO, or senior NCO, or an officer would do that. And then he would more or less give you a position taken off, say, a clock. If I had taken off a clock, say, spanned at 2 o'clock, when he had a rough idea what direction that was, if it was under 10 o'clock, he knew it was over to your left. And then you might get an order just to 2 or 3 rounds rapid fire in that position. You get up and you're firing, but you see nothing you're firing at, just living hopes.
So you pulled out to rest after a week. What happened to you then?
I pulled out. It would be night time, actually, when you came out. The cover of the darkness.
Does the other unit move in before you actually move out? How is a change over made?
The relieving unit would come up, and then of course that's when they knew your position, because you know where they're going to take over. They would come up and word would be exchanged between those who were here to relieve you and us going out. Thank God you were here, you know, get us out. And would say, well, you know, there's dead soldiers laid in certain positions nearby to you, and that the enemy was over there. And that sometimes, some position you could say, well, you can't hear the enemy talking at times. Otherwise, and that as I said before, you've been shouting out, you get some shouting out, and a name could be Bob, Bill, Jack, or something, come and help me and that, but we never used to reply to that. They used to hand over the ammunition, where that was, or if there was any ammunition just back slightly hidden in a position, and they don't explain that to them. You didn't even use to shake hands and say good luck at that. You'd maybe say good luck at you, or all the best lads, you know, get the best of it. They would take over your slip trench, you would get out. I mean, you didn't have to collate much, because your weapon and your smallpox was with you all the time. And then you would make your way back for the rest period. And the last man out would be nominated, and the person leading the section would shout back, you know. I said before, if it was last man, you went up to Smith and say, Smith. And you were there. And another point of this last man was even going into the line or going on the marches or that, it was known that the last man as Lucky Charlie. And Lucky Charlie, which anybody would volunteer for, and he was the one who was the farthest back of whatever movement there was. He could see where you were going and what happened. And if it was a desperate situation, Lucky Charlie could run away back there to where he'd come from and tell them exactly what had happened. Lucky Charlie.
So it was competition for that position?
Well, there could be if it was put up to a vote, I suppose, or volunteers, but it was a case of somebody who just detailed. You were last man, didn't you say? You were Lucky Charlie. That's what we used to call Lucky Charlie. Last man, Johnson.
How important is the wit in the group, the funny man in the group in an action situation, tense situation?
Well, I think a funny man would lose a bit of his funniness, a comedian, when he was there, and he just accepted it, same as the rest. It's funny because you get good days and bad, even in civilian life. You get a day where you're cheerful, and then you can get a day where everything's against you. And I think that applied to everybody. You know, about good days and bad days. If a man was on a bad day, or your mate was on a bad day, you would try to cheer him up and, you know, have a fag or that. We never thought of lung cancer then because they used this, get a free issue of cigarettes from the government. Well, you try and cheer him up, tell him not to worry, and you never know, a day or two later, he might have been saying the same to you.
I was thinking particularly of the man with the sense of humour who tends to somehow find a joke somewhere out of a desperate situation. Can take the tenseness away.
I can't sort of pinpoint any particular man doing that, a real funny man, as you say. I just can't visualise it more. I just don't remember. Not registering it all. But they always are funny people amongst everybody. Even if you're in a pub there, there's always somebody who will be funnier than the rest of you. But I can't just bring to mind any funny periods or anything like that.
I think you said on an earlier tape that when the battalion came out of the line at Anzio, you were down to, was it less than 100 men?
Less than 100, yeah.
Of which D Company was probably the strongest.
Yeah. D Company and a few of the headquarter company that was like part of the echelon. You say when you come out, what did you do? Well, let's say you changed over, and then of course you were on your way back out the line, was still at Anzio, and then this tank opened up to us, and eventually we got back to the echelon. There was tents there, and when I say the tent, like a two-man tent covering the hole in the ground. And the one that I was in before I got up to the line, when we got back to camp, we'd say, I went to this tent to kind of get in, and there was two chaps in it. These two chaps were part of the battalion that had relieved us and got in. So there was the other tents and that, plenty about where the battalion had been before they got up that far. So we just went there. They say next morning you were allowed a bit lay in, and then you'd be taken back in the trucks to mobile showers. And before you went in there, you were told no personal effects with you or anything in your pockets and that. But you got to the showers, you stripped everything off. And whatever the tent would hold, a big marquee, it wasn't only his shower's rigged up. He just stripped off the lot, went through the tent, showered off and that and out the other side, and then he got all nice clean uniforms, equipment there. Wasn't new, it was what had been dumped before, and then sent through the cleaners, and then he had to put it on. And that was a change of clothing. Then it was back to camp. And he would naturally have inspection of weapons and that, weapon inspection, and cleaning up and any other equipment that wanted, if you had any wanted changing, that was due, or equipment lost. Apparently, what they told me that after Dunkirk, the soldiers who lost equipment and lost rifles, that the government made them pay for it in the early stages of the war. That didn't occur with us. It was just a passing point.
At what point had you a roll call to work out who was missing and so forth?
Well, daily that was done. Daily the officer or senior NCO talking platoon-wise or even company-wise, we all had to send a daily return in so that the headquarters knew the strength of you. And they've got known cases there. And there was a pal of mine down south. And he was a company clerk. And he said, when we had reinforcements at one stage, he says, he hadn't even got the reinforcement marked on the company register. And the first notification he got was that he'd been killed in action. So reinforcements come up, they've gone into the line, and that was the end of it. So I think the Queen Soldiers training for ages takes days or weeks to get out abroad or get to the position, and they're finally posted to the unit where they're designated. And before they really entered onto the company records, they were killed in action.
So in an early morning situation in the front line, when you're in your slit trenches, was the roll call done by just shouting from trench to trench and you shout your name out?
Depended if you could know what the proximity of the enemy was, because you wouldn't shout, because the enemy was in shouting distance, hearing distance. So you get more or less pass on from one to the other to the next trench, you know, okay, two, still here and that, or one down, you know, and then you know, and that was faster. And to get the names to them as well, of course, and get the names.
And that was basically done by signs, you see?
Or if you could crawl between the trenches, you would do a crawl, or then you would crawl through, or even the opposite town. And that would go back daily to headquarters, what the position was with the personnel, number still active, or so on, number wounded, number killed.
In this first action of yours, this first week, did the men around you perform well? There was none of them that deserted or ran off?
No. Out of the hours with. You did get deserters, of course. We never heard much more of them because they were just sent off to a military establishment and you didn't get back to the unit. But there was a case that, see, apparently Montgomery, while he was in Africa, he said that any man who got wounded or parted from his regiment, he would get back to his regiment. I don't know whether you've heard or not, but there was a Salerno mutiny. You've heard about that, have you? And that was just based on, of course, the men not going back to the regiment they belonged to. But after that, there was far fewer training.
So after you come out of the line and you've been showered and clean equipment and so forth, what happened to you after that?
Well, this is an incident we'll tell you about. we were taken down after maybe 2 to 3 days to Anzio, and we were put onto ships there. At the Durham Light Infantry Union to go to in Durham. I remember one year that just talking to one of the ex airline ones, and he said, well, where did you end up, Judy? I said, oh, with the 56 London deal. And he mentioned, oh, I said, Anzio. I said, yes. He said, oh, and he said, I know when we came into Anzio, they relieved the division there. And he said, oh, they've taken off the 56 deal in a lifeboat. I mean, that was just a saying, but it just more or less referred that there wasn't a ship going to take off.
When
we went down to Anzio, we got onto the boats. As they pulled off, we didn't know where we were going. We pulled the way off. And I also remember there that there was a ship, which was a rocket firing ship. We'd never previously seen this rocket firing ship, and the number of rockets that went from a broadside away, virtually there must have been hundreds of them go over. And we were going out to sea, we were still shelled by the Germans. It didn't hit the ship at all, but shells did come over, and you see them bursting in the sea. From there we sailed, and we ended up in Egypt, Port Said.
What date would this be?
That would be about February 44.
And what happened to you there?
From Port Said we were put into a transit camp. There's quite a lot of transit camps in Egypt, but North Africa. We were put into a transit camp called Kassassin. I was known as Kassassin. It began with a Q and then an A. And getting back to when my school did, I was known as school to master saying to me, if any of you find a word that begins with Q and does not have U after it, come to me and I'll give you a shilling. And I thought, that's what we've got with this Kassassin, that word stuck in my mind. Anyhow, this is into a transit camp. From there, we got leave in Cairo, it's a week's leave. And we left this camp in sort of a convoy, troops going on leave. It wasn't the whole battalion together, but it was quite a large number. And on the left of the road, at north of number, there was a canal. We used to call this Sweetwater Canal. When the trucks had gone so fast, I can't remember the distance from Kassassin to Cairo, but anyhow, the trucks did stop for anybody to have a run off, whatever they wanted, by the side of the canal. And as a lot of places in Egypt, next thing you know, there was these wogs, as we call them, Arabs, who come up with a tray in front of them, similar to what they used to sell ice cream in cinemas. This chain, there's watches on, or there was eggs on it, or something like that. Of course, some of the eggs weren't always chicken eggs, some were snake eggs. And this convoy used to pull up, and of course, nobody sort of accepted the wogs or Arabs as brotherly neighbours. And from the first truck, they would drop, and from the rear truck would drop, and they would block the area between the road, the trucks, and the water canal, sweet water canal. And that's where a lot of these wogs ended up, got off the trucks. And further on, you could see Egyptians, and they were getting water out of this canal, they were washing in it, they were doing everything in it. And even to a dead donkeys floating down this canal. I also remember it. This Kassassin wasn't a great distance from a place called Ismailia in Egypt. Anyhow, from there we went into Cairo, and we were sort of split up to accommodations, which some were more or less largish houses or private houses, but it was I suppose they would call it, in kind of more of a selected area than the Arab quarters where it was wood or things like that. We never got down to them. And we had the weeks there, we made the most of it as we could. He used to, into Cairo, they used to do the bars. And if you wanted a, you would get your breakfast, and then I'd get out into Cairo and midday instead of going back to wherever you were for me, and maybe have some egg and chips. Eggs, the number of eggs, what's the other than chips? I don't know. And then from there it was the bars, or it used to be the nightclubs.